wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick talks with Willamette University historian Bill Smaldone about Germany's dependence on Russia for natural gas and oil. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss what progressive gun legislation might look like in the wake of so many mass shootings. And Desiree Helliger speaks with students about organizing to cancel student debt. First up on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick speaking with Bill Smaldone about Germany's dependence on Russia for its natural gas and oil for heating and cooling, electric power, and transport, and how with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Germany, Europe's wealthiest country and political leader, has committed to become self-sufficient. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Bill Smaldone. Welcome to Cable again.
Hi, Bill. Great to be back.
Bill Smaldone teaches history at Willamette University in Salem. His books, research, and writing are on modern German history. His books include Confronting Hitler and European Socialism, A Concise History with Documents. In his spare time, he's the founder and still chair of the board of KMUZ Radio, and like cable here in Portland, KMUZ's in Salem. It's a member-owned and operated, democratically-run radio station. And he's also president of the Willamette University undergraduate faculty. This is Bill Resnick of the Old Mole Variety Hour Collective interviewing Bill Smaldone on whether this world that's in ghastly shape with the planet hurtling toward climate warming cataclysm that climate science says will wipe out most humans if not stopped, that global roasting is caused by human action, can be ameliorated by human action. In fact, science has developed all the means of stopping, reversing that global roasting at modest cost. But little has been done or is planned. Indeed, all the major countries, but perhaps one to be discussed today, nearly all are greatly increasing their military and surveillance budgets, focusing on making war, or all of them say defending against war. There's only one big shooting war now in Ukraine, but many smaller shooting wars, mostly financed by the richer countries in Yemen and Congo and Ethiopia, Colombia, Myanmar, Syria, also Israel, Palestine. Then there's many military buildups and constant maneuvers and probing between countries, as in Pakistan, India, U.S., China, and the South China Sea, U.S. and Israel versus Iran, North and South Korea, most of them with the U.S. in reserve. But only nine of those nations have nuclear weapons, the U.S. and Russia, 5,000 apiece. In this sorry picture, the U.S. is, of course, in a class by itself with over 700 military bases around the world, large numbers of secret units, drone wars, too. No one knows how many missions per day they're flying. And we haven't even mentioned the war on the streets in U.S. North America and, of course, in the schools. This is all widely known and in fact, the Semitic effects disseminated by peace groups. Yet the peace movement around the world is marginal at best. So, with that, Bill, sorry picture, your job is to shine a ray of hope. Because if there's one country that's somewhat less involved in war and more in modulating the forces of war and also doing more to alleviate climate change, seems to me the country is modern Germany, where you have lived for some time and you study and write about. So, Bill, tell us about Germany's foreign and military policies, especially its relations with the countries involved in the Ukraine war, and, of course, especially this country.
Well, Bill, maybe I should provide an overview of Germany's history of attempting to secure raw materials for itself. The raw material problem is a perpetual problem for Germany, which is a relatively small country compared to the United States. It is about the size of the Pacific Northwest and has 80 million people, right? So it's not very large and it is quite crowded. It has some natural resources. For example, the northwestern areas of Germany, the area in the Ruhr River Valley region, was quite rich in coal deposits, and that allowed Germany to develop energy in the 19th and 20th century that was based on hard coal production. Germany also had quite a bit of brown coal in its eastern provinces, and during the Cold War, the communist state of East Germany was quite reliant on brown coal for all kinds of energy production and also for the production of key products, especially in the chemical industries. Now, why is this important? It's important to note that German industry has long been oriented around exports. So the Germans are renowned for not only having very productive heavy industrial sectors, so the production of things like steel, but also for producing very high quality consumer products, usually produced in small and medium-sized firms, products that require high precision in the production process. And the mixture of German heavy industry, middle-sized precision industry, high quality across the board, all of those things come together to make Germany a very powerful exporter of consumer goods and other kinds of finished products. This has been necessary. That is, it's important for Germany to export those kinds of products because it has to import many of the things that it needs, one, to feed itself, but also to carry out basic industrial production. So Germany has long been oriented around the need to export goods in order to purchase the imports that it needs to feed its population and to provide all the things that a modern industrial society requires. So for a long time, the German state has been, you know, very attuned to making sure that German industry, the German capital, has access to the raw materials it needs, has access to the markets it needs, and so on. And it has pursued various strategies to get those things. So, for example, in the first part of the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, German government sought to establish German hegemony in Europe. That is, to subjugate all of the surrounding states, either by force, such as in World War I, or via treaties, bilateral treaties mainly, that provided Germany with an advantage in the acquiring of the raw materials it needed and the markets that its industries needed. So World War I was fought, for example, to allow German capital to establish its domination in Central Europe. Right? The goal was to establish what the Germans called Mitteleuropa, or Central Europe. And by that, they essentially meant that Germany would dominate the whole area from France to Poland, and that it would be basically able to dominate all of its neighbors and to secure for itself the raw materials and markets it needed to develop its economy. So that was essentially the core of the project, right, that was World War I for German capital. And that project or that effort was defeated, right, with Germany's defeat in 1918. And then for the interwar period, Germany essentially had to recover from that military defeat, but also it had to get its legs again in terms of its economic equilibrium. So it had lost all of its colonies as a result of the war. Some of the major parts of the country that produced coal, for example, the eastern region of Silesia was lost to Poland. The Germans were in a rather disadvantageous economic situation during the interwar period, and this fueled the belief by many Germans that it was necessary, in a sense, to resume the effort, right, to reestablish German domination over Europe. And that was essentially what amounted to World War II. So when Hitler launched the Second World War in 1939, one of the goals of the German government, in addition to establishing a new racial order in Europe, annihilating the people that were not regarded as Aryans, but were regarded as subhuman, so for example, Jews and Slavs, in addition to that very large goal, the German regime intended to establish what it called a Großraumwirtschaft area. That means a large economic space, right? Something that could be compared with the continental empire of the United States. And that would allow Germany to establish economic autarky, right? With domestic supplies, full domestic supplies of agricultural and raw materials coming from Eastern Europe, right? Fueling German industry back in the home country, so to speak. And so the Germans attempted in the Second World War to conquer all of Europe, to subordinate Western Europe to its economic interests, and to establish a greater German empire in Eastern Europe that would come under the direct control of the regime and that would allow the hyper-exploitation of Eastern Europe's raw material resources. That was also defeated in 1945. So from 1914 to 1945, the German state attempted to secure its economic interests largely by military means. After 1945, as a result of the total defeat of Nazi Germany, German political leaders had to set about establishing different kinds of relations with their neighbors in order to secure their economic interests. Once again, remember, the need to import raw materials that would allow industry to produce the goods that could be exported so that Germany could acquire the materials it needed for a modern economy. This was true both in West Germany, okay, which was that half of Germany that was allied to the Western capitalist countries during the Cold War, and East Germany, which was part of the Soviet-organized Eastern Bloc and had a centrally planned economy. Despite the fact that the Western economy was more market-oriented and the Eastern economy was more state-oriented, by and large, they needed to accomplish the same things, and that is to export finished goods in return for raw materials. One of the interesting things about that, by the way, was that the West Germans had a huge advantage in that almost all of the hard coal reserves were in Western Germany, and hard coal is a superior burning coal that is much more useful to industry than brown coal. And brown coal is what the East Germans had available. The other thing to note is that in the middle of the 20th century, Germany, both West and East, began to undertake a transition to oil use. So they began a gradual shift from dependence on coal to dependence on oil. The problem for both West and East Germany was that neither state had any oil, and so everything had to be imported. And so the Western German economy became very much dependent on imports from places like the Middle East, and Eastern Germany became dependent on imports from the Soviet Union. The East Germans also used oil imports to their advantage on the world market because they would purchase at below cost oil from the Soviet Union and then sell it on the world capitalist market at world market rates, and they would pocket the difference, and that allowed them to use some of that money, that hard currency earned, to purchase goods that they needed abroad. So energy politics in Germany, West and East, during the Cold War was very important. Both of those states, West and East Germany, were the leading states of their respective blocs. They were producers of a wide range of high-quality industrial and consumer goods. Both of them were major chemical producers. Both of them were heavily dependent on coal resources and oil resources. When Germany was unified in 1990, these dependencies continued. So coal and oil were still really important. Germany remained very much dependent on the imports of those products, especially as local supplies were not enough to satisfy Germany's industrial needs. And so to sum things up, let's just say that in the 20th century, energy politics were extremely important to the health of the German economy, and Germany was hard-pressed to secure adequate supplies of energy in order to meet the industrial needs of the country and also the civilian needs. As Germany urbanized, as Germany became increasingly dependent on things like, you know, mass transit and highly urbanized cities, right, which are very energy intensive, it needed ever more supplies of energy, of raw materials for energy production to meet those needs, the needs of a modern economy. The last thing I'll say is that toward the end of the 20th century, there was increasing recognition within Germany about the environmental damage wrought by industrialization. This was very important to the rise of the green movement in West Germany, and it was very important also to the development of a green opposition in East Germany. And this environmental consciousness led to a kind of early realization that Germany's use of energy, that is, the use of coal and oil, was highly destructive to the local and to the global environment. And so the German ecological movement, which is politically represented by the Greens, began to make its mark toward the end of the 20th century and became particularly important in the 21st century within Germany's parliamentary system. And this has forced all the other political parties, including the center-right parties like the Christian Democrats, to recognize the importance of environmental issues, to recognize the importance of the energy sector and the need to move toward more sustainable sources of energy such as solar and wind. And the Germans, beginning in the 1990s, I would say, launched a series of efforts to make their energy use more sustainable, and in doing so have catapulted Germany into the leadership of the European Union and have transformed the state into a global leader in the transition to renewable energy. They have long ago left the United States in the dust. For a while, the United States was sort of the model, you know, based on the creation of the EPA in 1972 and the well-deserved reputation for American ecological activists, right, for leading the charge in the late 20th century toward a more sustainable economy or a more sustainable environmental policy. The Germans saw that from afar, and they jumped on the bandwagon and have now left the Americans, I would say, well behind.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bill Smaldone, Willamette University historian, wrote the books Confronting Hitler and European Socialism, A Concise History with Documents. We've been discussing the history of Germany, a very highly populated country with needs for goods from overseas. It developed an export economy of precision goods, sells all over the world, and then, in fact, became environmentally conscious in the 20th century and have left any other country way behind in terms of responding to climate change and reducing their greenhouse gas pollution. Bill, let's talk about now the Ukraine. Any war, of course, would be a country like Germany, of course, who lost two wars, sacrificed millions and millions of people, was bombed to death by the United Kingdom and the United States, who took vengeance on European cities and destroyed a number of medieval cities in Europe, spared a few, actually. In any event, they had terrible war experiences on the one hand, and they had needs to have friendly relations with economies all over the world, like China, who is deeply involved in the Ukraine war. China and Russia are allies. China, of course, is an economic powerhouse. Russia's a basket case. Russia really can't do anything without China's approval, and they obviously did approve. So in that situation, it seems to me, having good relations with China because of trade, would tell us how this impacted their behavior with regard to the Ukraine. And war is just terrible for an economy that exports and imports because the trade routes are blocked, the production of food in the world is now in bad shape. They're really threatened. Why don't you talk about that?
So let me be very clear. Let me say that during the Cold War, I noted that West Germany became the leading state of Western Europe among the capitalist countries, and East Germany became the most important economic driver of the East Bloc economy. And by that, I mean that both states, in a sense, could dominate their neighbors. They were able to increase exports into those regions, right, and to become a major supplier of all kinds of industrial and consumer goods. When the Cold War ended, a giant vacuum was created in Eastern Europe, into which, because the Soviet Union collapsed, right, and East Germany collapsed. And so somebody was going to have to go in there and pick up the threads, right, of the trading connections, the supply routes, all of the flow of goods and services in the region had to be reconfigured. And Germany was in an excellent position to move into that vacuum. And so East Germany's dominance gave way to the dominance really of Germany as a whole in Eastern Europe. German capital flowed into the region. Many German corporations located new production facilities in the East. They either bought up old production facilities and renovated them or closed them down, or they established new facilities in the East. One of the best examples of that is Volkswagen, which became a major auto producer in places like the Czech Republic. And so German capital flowed into Eastern Europe, and one has to understand that as NATO moved eastward, right, as the Western military alliance expanded over the course of two decades into Eastern Europe and absorbed into its ranks countries like Poland and the Baltic states, Czechoslovakia and Hungary and the Balkans, simultaneously, right, those states were drawn into the European Union trading networks. Okay, they became eventually a part of the European Union political bloc. And so you have being formed in Eastern Europe, a European Union, right, in which the German economy stands at the center. It's the most important economy in the whole of the EU. Germany, therefore, is also a very powerful political player, right? And one of the German political goals in the last 20 years, actually longer, since 1990, has been to promote strong economic ties with the former Soviet Union, right, with Russia and with the other countries in the region in order to secure the kinds of raw materials that it has long needed. So, for example, Germany in the 20th century became increasingly dependent on oil and gas imports. Russia is a huge producer of oil and gas. Newly united Germany, therefore, was quite ready and willing to trade with Russia, to ship Russia industrial products, finished goods, in return for larger and larger imports of gas and oil, conveyed to Germany not only by ship, but also by pipelines that crossed countries like Ukraine, and most recently that were built under the surface of the Baltic Sea, coming directly into German markets. And so Germany, you know, the Cold War was over. Germany expanded its reach into Eastern Europe, both economic and political. It promoted closer and closer relations with Russia and its satellite states in the region.
Hi, folks. You just heard me, Bill Resnick, talking to Bill Smaldone, a historian of modern Germany at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Bill Smaldone co-founded KMUZ Radio and is president of the board. His books include Confronting Hitler and A Concise History of European Socialism. Today's was the first part of a two-part interview that discusses how Germany could lead the world in transforming their respective economies. In part one, Bill Smaldone pointed out that Germany's geography and demography dictated an economy depending on export and import, and that required an internationalist perspective, of course, only after losing two world wars. In part two, to play next week, Monday, on the Old Mole, Bill and I will point out that Germany is well positioned to lead that international mobilization to stop global roasting and show why that's possible.
Pablo with Music Maestro. It followed Bill Resnick and Jim Smaldone discussing Germany's decision to cease its reliance on fuel imported from Russia. Up next in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about America's failure to pass gun legislation and about what progressive gun legislation might look like. They also talk about the expected ruling of the Supreme Court in overturning limits on gun ownership. Here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, Mike, last month we talked about the leaked Supreme Court document written by Justice Alito that lays out the perverse legal reasoning behind his gang of justices and their intent to overturn Roe v. Wade, a ruling that could come down this month. And now, after recent horrific mass shootings in this country, the U.S. Supreme Court's reactionary majority is likely to make a ruling soon that will make the nation's gun violence problem even worse. So let's start with how these upcoming Supreme Court decisions are related. How are they related in their underlying political worldview?
Well, their underlying view is the present majority of people do not have power, and that a minority of people with a determined agenda based on basically fraudulent history is going to extend its reach to all parts of modern life. They're going to create a sort of gun culture. In their dream world, everybody could carry automatic weapons as you go. So just the sort of fear that women have traditionally felt about their ability to move through society is going to be extended to create an atmosphere of fear, because everybody will be able to exercise their newly discovered fundamental right to carry automatic and semi-automatic weapons in the world. That's their long-range goal, and they're making remarkably long strides towards that goal in this term.
Well, part of what seems baffling to many observers is the difficulty in even passing what Biden has called reasonable gun restrictions, like the limits on assault weapons. Or let's look at this New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin case coming up before the Supreme Court, likely this month. What's the reasoning there and what's at stake there?
Well, it's a remarkable political transformation. My granddad in central Illinois was a member of the NRA because he liked to go duck hunting. He had an English pointer dog, and the NRA taught him gun safety. He would, for 2 weeks a year in the autumn, it was one of his favorite pastimes. The NRA was a very traditional organization, focused more on gun safety than anything else. But over time, they have learned the possibilities of profit from fear. The NRA has become very adept at creating fear. They've learned that the creation of fear increases sales of weaponry, and the weapons makers have financed an expansion of fear in general and weaponry in particular, centered on the NRA as their spear point. So until 2008, there was no such thing as a fundamental right to bear arms. The actual constitutional language in the Second Amendment is that a well-regulated militia being necessary for state protection, the people have the right to bear and keep arms. So it was all in the context of a well-regulated militia, fear at that time by states that the federal government could overwhelm them. It had absolutely nothing to do with single weapons. Weapons at that time took about a minute to reload. They could fire one shot. But in 2008, Justice Scalia authored an opinion called District of Columbia versus Heller. That was the first case to declare that gun ownership was a fundamental right.
You mean an individual right and not right. Based on a collective militia formation.
Right. He sort of forgot all about that critical conditional first clause. And they held that people had the right to own guns in their homes. But that opinion made it clear that communities still had the right to keep dangerous modern weapons off the streets. It said nothing in there about it would limit your ability to protect yourself. But that was not nearly good enough for gun worshippers. In this new case, the New York State Rifle Association, New York's had a law like California does and like many, many other states, saying that only people with specific needs could be licensed to carry a concealed weapon. You had to have, quote, proper cause. That law is being challenged. The new law wants not only to erase that particular ban that would preclude people from carrying concealed weapons without some reason to do so, but they're further asking the court not to rely on current public safety concerns. They have a whole phantasmagoric system of figuring history that involves citing to 14th century medieval English texts. Just like in the abortion case, they rely on Matthew Hale, a medieval judge who presided over witch trials, and his statement that abortions were a, quote, major crime triumphed the fact that in this country, for a couple hundred years, abortions, so long as a child had not yet, quote, quickened, was a common practice. And in the state of Oregon, as late as 1910, were, quote, not a crime. They pick and choose from history with particular fondness for medieval sources in order to justify the results they want to reach.
There seems to be a particular bizarre, cruel irony in the fetishizing of the fetus and the fetishizing of guns, these lethal weapons that have been used to mow down young school children alongside of this passionate protection of the fetus, the unborn. How do you understand how those two feverishly protected rights stand side by side? That seems so contradictory.
Well, they love guns more than kids. That's clear as a bell. To me, it's baffling, but it shows the power in this country of a dedicated minority. You know, a vivid example is Cuba, which is a place where most people, having no strong feelings about it, would interact with Cuba in the same way they would with other countries. And they don't, when considering where to go for a tourist visit, look at the nature of the administration of a particular country. But there are people in South Florida who care deeply about Cuba, who make it their life's work to overturn the present government, and they get their way because
they've had an enormous influence over our political system.
And it's the same way with gun fetishists. I mean, they exalt guns into like objects to be worshipped. And how and why they do that is a mystery to me. I think the most simple explanation is simply one of profits, that because fear motivates behavior, spending behavior, it's something that Facebook and other social media companies have learned. If there's stress and fear, conflict, that heightens engagement. And that means there are more clicks. And that means there's a higher rate to be charged for monetizing every individual who clicks. It could be simply that the increase in crime, which was real in this country in the late 60s and 70s, was exploited quite successfully by the NRA and continued to develop that fear even long after crime began to seriously diminish in this millennium. And they managed to keep the fear of crime high enough that people keep buying weapons. So there's been a tremendous expansion of weaponry. We now have more than 400 million guns in this country. In the teeth of clear evidence that right to carry states have higher murder rates, have much higher suicide rates, that violence is increased, and the obvious evidence of the Uvalde case is classic. There's an 18-year-old kid. He's not doing anything illegal. He turns 18. Then he goes down to the store. He buys a weapon capable of spewing 16 bullets a second. He buys 1,000 rounds of ammunition. And nobody thinks twice in Texas, or at least let me amend that quickly. The powers that be in Texas have created a world in which that's normal behavior.
And a cost they're willing to bear. Let's talk about the costs to gun manufacturers and what's happening on that front. Earlier this year, families of the victims of the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook School reached a historic $73 million settlement with Remington Arms. And this was the first time a firearms manufacturer has settled a lawsuit brought by gun violence victims since Congress granted the industry sweeping immunity from civil liability in 2005. But some observers have argued that unlike lawsuits against drug makers that have been successful and the tobacco industry and the opioid pharmaceutical companies in their role in the opioid epidemic, the gun manufacturers are much more fortified by this protection from civil liability granted by Congress. So what's the prospect of those lawsuits going forward, given how they are living, these gun manufacturers, in their own political fortress?
Well, there is a fortress protecting an army of lobbyists that have been very successful all over the country in 100 ways. They have managed to repeal the laws like the one at issue now in New York State in 2/3 of our states. So the biggest states, California, New York, still have them, but many, many states have lost them. Most states have now been forbidden from allowing suits to go ahead against gun manufacturers. Their liability has been limited. There's a range of laws passed to protect gun manufacturers and to enhance their powers in virtually every state. And the Sandy Hill litigation was brilliant. It was very ingenious. They found an ad financed by Remington with had a kid holding a weapon, which contradicted statements that they had made under oath. So there were unique circumstances in that litigation, but it was very difficult, but it was very successful and I think should be pursued. There are always some avenue. There's always a new way. There's always a way to exploit statements someone made somewhere, and they should be pursued. But I think we have to think big, Jan. We have to think about limiting the power of the Supreme Court, which is acting now as that sort of national equivalent of the South Floridians who work solely and all day long on the Cuban issue. Their power can be limited legislatively. They can be limited in many ways. Not only can the court be expanded, but it can be, the reach of its opinions can be limited by legislation. We need to think like that. They're, of course, recognizing the unpopularity of many of their decisions. Voting rights are a key target of this new minority that has taken over. We need to think about somehow undermining the Supreme Court's power and somehow making this country more susceptible to what the majority of people in it want, and recognizing that we're no longer a rural white nation, that most people in Texas, as well as Oregon and California, live in cities and are forced to and are pleased by mixing it up with people from other cultures. That's the modern world that has been steadily increasing in every way for the last century. And this effort to hold it back, to pretend that it doesn't exist, to fantasize about what medieval England might have been like, is something that we need to strive mightily to stop.
It's sobering indeed and daunting what the forces arrayed and that are connected with the gun violence issue that seem to continue a campaign that has been traced to the Reagan era, and where government itself, the federal government, and the ability of the government to make and enforce laws that address public needs has become the enemy of the right, and dismantling the government, making government dysfunctional as a primary political project.
That's true. I think right now there is a conjunction between the slaughter of young children at Uvalde and the U.S. Supreme Court issuing, as they will do in about a week, an opinion expanding weapon rights that would allow further opportunities for people like the killer at Uvalde to do what he did. It is something that we should seize as best we can.
Yeah. And to see in this the exploitation of terror and horror and terrorizing people as part of a right-wing worldview. Well, Mike, we'll continue to take this up as we continue with the left and the law. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Okay.
"41 Shots" by Bruce Springsteen here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and "Left in the Law" with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. Up next, Desiree Helliger is talking with WSU Vancouver students Flaffy Poley, Ella Allman, and Andrea Mansky about organizing to cancel student debt. Here's Desiree Helliger's for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
In late March, with the debt collective ramping up for an April 4th National Day of Action, I decided to give students in my 17th and 18th century literature course at Washington State University, Vancouver, an optional assignment on student debt and calls for President Biden to use his executive authority to cancel nearly $1.8 trillion in student debt, an article entitled "Stealing and Selling Nature, Why We Need to Reclaim the Commons" by Portland teacher Tim Swinehart of Rethinking Schools, provided students with a theoretical and historical foundation for discussing links between the enclosure of the commons in early modern England and the privatization of higher education in the U.S. today. Students were quick to pick up on the links between indentured servants in the colonial United States and the millions of Americans today who are saddled for decades and often life with student debt. Students who opted for the assignment wrote brief essays about the impact of student debt in their own lives and or in the lives of friends and family. They shared their essays with one another before joining work groups to research the issue and begin mapping out different dimensions of a campus campaign that included a student survey, a resolution calling for the cancellation of student debt, and rather unexpectedly, graduating seniors using their commencement ceremony as a platform to call for President Biden to cancel student debt. This past week, I spoke with three students from the course, Flaffy Poley, Mimi Poo, Nez Perce student Ella Allman, and Andrea Mansky, about student debt and their work on the campaign. We start with Flaffy Poley. In his work for the course, Flaffy took point in developing a survey to gather campus-wide data about the impact of student debt on the lives of WSU Vancouver students, with the goals of opening up a broader campus dialogue on the issue and of presenting the data to the Student Senate and WSU administrators. Talk a little bit about why you felt so strongly about this work, because you really threw yourself into this project, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, why do you feel so strongly about it?
I know so many people around me, so many students around me who are struggling with paying for school. I got lucky enough to get money to go to school. Mm-hmm. So many of my classmates are worried about having children right now because they don't think that they're going to be financially stable to do so. Apparently, you know, 41% of students at schools experience food insecurity. And with how much like minimum wage is, there's no way we could handle paying this much along with paying for our food and paying for our needs. And we have to rely on debt. We have to take out loans. We have to owe somebody money. And to me, that just looks like a giant chain. We consider student debt to be a very silent problem, and we wanted to make it very vocal.
Next, we hear from Ella and Andrea.
In our class, we were having these discussions and how student debt is impacting all of these different people in my classes and hearing these individual stories. And I think it kind of hit me, the burden that is on everyone. It's not just me, and I have a very light burden compared to many. So I realized how important it was then. And so I decided to organize a sort of action at our graduation to bring more attention to the issue. So we ended up wearing ribbons with our student debt amounts on our gowns at graduation, as well as decoration on our cap that was calling for President Biden to cancel student debt.
It's basically like a sign on your mortar boards.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so it was good. We had some faculty participate as well, and got a little shout out during the graduation ceremony, which was pretty cool. So I was
an administrator administrator. Yeah. And people really applauded, right? I mean, the crowd really, obviously there was a lot of support for the action. I know the burden of student debt has weighed really heavily on you.
Yeah, I can't help but agree with that. I don't qualify for a lot of the programs, you know, that a lot of other students do. I don't come from a wealthy background at all. Currently working 3 jobs and taking on massive amounts of student loans in hopes that I can maybe get a job once I graduate, because there is no guarantee that I'm going to be able to get a job, that I'm not going to be, you know, a bartender or something like that for the rest of my life. So I think that I perpetually live, and not just myself, a lot of other students perpetually live with the stress of, am I financially and fiscally ruining myself for the rest of my life in the hopes of the American dream, quote unquote. So yeah, it's a lot. It's hard not to be stressed all the time.
So for me, I noticed a lot hearing the different stories in our class and from my classmates. I was really struck by how the burden weighs on people differently. Like, I know there was a few people who talked a lot about mental health and how the mental health impact that having this amount of student debt has. And I think that's not something that's usually talked about when you like are bringing up the student debt debate. You know, I say debates in quotes because I don't think it should be a debate, but often people don't talk about the mental health side of it. It's only financial. It's only, what is this doing to our economy? What is this doing to the big systems? And we don't look at it on person level, like what that does to you as a person, knowing you won't be able to buy a house. You won't be able to maybe like pay the other bills that you have. You won't be able to start a family when you want to, because maybe your partner has student debt and you can't get married. Like the pressure of all of it on individual people. And then on, you know, the big collective issue of it being a whole system that is like oppressing millions in our country. So I was really struck by that.
And we heard students really talking about how, you know, well before they got to university, that it was already kind of shaping their understanding of their possibilities for the future. And it was already stressing people out in junior high and in high school to know that there was going to come a point where they were going to have to assume this massive debt that they would basically carry for decades.
Yeah, that's something that really spoke to me. That's kind of my experience. I come from a very, middle class family that doesn't make enough money to pay for college, but makes too much to get the support to, you know, have it paid for. And so my parents, from when I was a little kid, like elementary school, I've always been very academically driven. And they always said, if you want to go to college, you're going to have to pay for it. Like, we just can't do it. We're telling you now, we can't do it. And so I was like, okay, I need to work hard. And I took all of the advanced classes I could. I did AP classes in high school. I did Running Start for 2 full-time years. So I graduated high school with my AA to try to get as much done as possible. And I still had to take out student loans. I've been thinking about getting my college degrees and taking out these loans since I was literally in elementary school.
Yeah, Andrea, did you want to jump in?
I'm the first person in my family to go to college. So I don't think there was ever an expectation or even a thought that, you know, that any of us would be able to not only go to college, but like actually like at a university level. So I kind of assumed, I guess I had hoped, coming back to college at 30, since I'm only a bartender, that I would kind of meet some of those low income guidelines in order to maybe get some help on my college. But I think that even the way that the poverty line is measured in the United States right now is so completely far off and so unjustified. Now's the time to act on trying to get some of these systems to change and to move forward. And I think that if we don't do it now, when the opportunity is actually here, you know, when people are actually talking about potentially canceling some student debt, all student debt, why stop now? You know, why let those systems that are in place to kind of drag you down and bring you down, why let them? Why can't we, you know, bully our politicians into canceling student debt? I'm all for it.
So we really do have this very unique window under Biden, right? Because he's made this campaign promise. And right now what we're hearing is possibly he might forgive $10,000. I mean, what do you think about that?
We're both just shaking our heads. That's how I feel about it. I think it's insulting. I've done everything I can and I still have $15,000 of debt just for my bachelor's, and I'm going to go to school and get my master's and that's going to be more. My partner has around $50,000 just for her bachelor's degree, you know? So what is $10,000 to that? I know a lot of other people who have $50,000 to $100,000 just from their bachelor's degrees, like easily. That's just, it's insulting.
I mean, that's just what you've accumulated at the point of graduation, and that debt really, really balloons. And I just want to say it was very dramatic to see people actually having that figure on the ribbons, right? Demonstrating that debt burden at graduation. And this, other universities are graduating in the next week. This is an action that can be pulled off in a week, right? You need some white ribbon and Sharpies. And I'm sure you'd be happy to share the template that you developed that says, you know, Biden cancel student debt with the university logo on it. What would it be like if between now and next June, every high school or university graduation was transformed into a call to Biden to cancel student debt, right? Could he stand up against that kind of wave? And you've got thousands of people in attendance at these university events. So it's a great captive audience. And again, I mean, people in the stadium applauded the fact that this event had been organized. Can you say anything about why it was important to, you know, to initiate this organizing within a class? Why was it so important to actually teach student debt?
I think it's crucial. I mean, we're so busy. College students are so busy. I mean, I've been working all through school. I know Andrea has been working an extremely crazy amount all through school. And there's so many things that I would have been involved in. There's so many things I wanted to do and wanted to push for and wanted to organize that I haven't been able to because I just cannot sacrifice that time away from my schooling and away from my work because that's what I have to do to survive. So incorporating these actions into the classroom, it allows us, like, it frees up time to put more energy into these important issues that we are so passionate about. And it also, like, I think opens the door to have these conversations with people that you wouldn't have these conversations with otherwise. I was really struck by, in our class conversations, how many people didn't know about our university's history as a land-grant university. And that is so important to know. I feel like as the university sort of has an obligation to tell us, you know, the truth of like where the university comes from and where our money is going. And so I think it's kind of twofold. Like, it gives us the time and the energy to actually organize in these ways and have the ability to do that. But it also is kind of like, I think, fulfilling the university's promise to us to like give us the full, like the best and fullest education they can. It's crucial to incorporate into like curriculum and class time.
You know, for listeners who may not be aware, a moral act in the 19th century alienated, it's between, I think, 13 and 11 million acres of indigenous land. And WSU capitalized through the appropriation of, I think it's 91,000 acres of indigenous land, and WSU is still in possession of about 73,000 acres of indigenous land. So Ella, I think you were also pointing out California, the California system is now providing free tuition to all Native students, right? Out of that recognition that, you know, the land grant colleges were established on the backs of indigenous communities that continue to be disproportionately shut out of higher education. And so you know, as a Nimiipuu Nez Perce person, you have not had the benefit of free tuition, right?
The majority of the land that WSU took during the Morrill Act and then continues to retain is Nimiipuu land. So, you know, I'm not registered Nimiipuu, and that's a whole other issue. But yeah, I think it's insane that Native students don't get free tuition. Like, federally, there's this whole other thing on top of it that, like, as a land grab university, the whole point was to give free and accessible education to the people of Washington, to spread that education here. Us having these incredible amounts of debt and tuition placed upon us is really a departure from the past and from, like, the point of the university.
Incrementally, these public universities, through the dynamics of neoliberalism beginning in like the mid-70s, have been incrementally privatized, and the debt becomes individual. You know, many people are now carrying it into old age, right? We know that people in their 70s, their Social Security can be garnished for student debt. It's the one form of debt that cannot be discharged through bankruptcy or other means. It's an issue that affects young children who are being raised by parents who are carrying student debt, and it's affecting people on the far end of the spectrum who, you know, may be rendered homeless as a result of, houseless as a result of carrying that debt.
I think one of the things in discussing the amount of debt that we have and kind of discussing the anxiety surrounding that in a classroom setting, I think one of the things that is really important that, you know, a lot of people in the United States, a larger percentage than you think are really, really close to that houselessness. A medical emergency, anything can really push people to that point. I think that a lot of people are a lot closer than we realize. And I think that was one of the really important points that we kind of came to. And I think that also, you know, for so long, there's been a focus on tearing the system down. I think now is the time to focus on rebuilding with each other.
And that sort of goes to the focus on the commons, right? That we really, you know, we need a commons. We have a right to a commons. We need water. We need public education. What would you like to say to other students around the area who are graduating next week?
I would say that this is the time. I know Andrea said this earlier, but it really is the time. There is so much momentum. There is so much conversation that is being had that hasn't been there in the past, you know? And I think we really do have the opportunity to make a change if we stand up collectively. I think that's really the important thing that I've come away with. The community that I felt in our classroom when we were all talking about our experiences and the things that we've gone through with this student debt and then are going to go through, like, it really made me feel so, like, welcomed and, like, in this sense of community that I hadn't experienced in the classroom previously, really. And so I think beyond even just making this change, you know, finding that community in your peers and finding this collective thing that we can all work towards is really, really powerful. But also that we have the platform and we have the opportunity here to bring about real change if we just stand up and do it, you know?
I want to mention too that, you know, Andrea has been working on a WSU Vancouver Student Senate resolution, right? To try to get a resolution passed through the Student Senate. And also, hopefully, we're going to take that resolution, we hope, also to the city of Vancouver and to the county. And get these, this is really the model of the debt collective, right? They've developed these sample resolutions that we're working to adapt.
You've been listening to a dialogue about student debt cancellation featuring WSU students Flaffy Poli and Andrea Mansky and new WSU Vancouver alum, Ella Allman. Congratulations, Ella. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
On my grizzly, yeah, since way back. No sir, and I don't drive a Maybach. But guess what I did?
I finished paying, selling Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach.
My name is D1. Let me tell you what I've been through when it come to Sally. She call me at least twice a day. She want our money badly. Calling me from different numbers. Ooh, she thinks she slick. But I got them all memorized. I hit ignore quick. Needed tuition. Needed room and board. Had to pay for books. So I took out loans to feed the boy. Graduated. Wasn't making quite enough to pay him back. Went in default. Messed my credit up. Check my Equifax. I ain't proud of that, I'm more proud of that, I ain't drowning that. I got two jobs, really got on my grind, no time to whine, I can't ride the pine. In the game right now, my time to shine. Started paying them loans back one at a time. Got them down, till I paid them all off. Peace sign. For those who doubted me, yeah, this is payback. And I've been on my grizzly, yeah, since way back. No sir, and I don't drive a Maybach. But guess what I did? I finished paying, selling Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach. Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach. Maybach. I finished paying, selling Maybach. Maybach. Look, is it $40,000? $50,000, $60,000, or maybe it's more. Is it $80,000, $90,000, $100,000? How much do you owe? Is it $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, or maybe it's more?
That was Sally Mae by D1, following Desiree Helliger's segment on canceling student debt. And this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for June 6th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Desiree Helliger's, Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Flaffy Poley, Ella Allman, Andrea Mansky, and Jim Smaldone. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. ¶¶